thanks for coming, then. So the title, I'm not sure it made it. Oh.
A little too high.
Yeah, and I'm not that tall, so you're tall. I have the, here I have the.
There's a yellow rope up there.
Yeah, it didn't seem to work. I'll try again. Oh, yeah, it does work. It's just very heavy. Yeah, okay. That's tangled. Okay. So that doesn't look good. Try again. Yeah.
Yeah, you might want to.
Okay, hopefully that's still good. So I'm not sure my title made it onto the web. It certainly didn't make it onto the printed program that I got. So there is the title. Why should and why can the path integral serve as the basis for quantum theory of gravity? So the meeting so far has been focused.
Say,
Perimeter
Institute.
Oh, yes, thanks for pointing that out. That's not an accident that I abbreviated path integral as PI. So I mean, maybe the gods are, the same gods of the IT world are telling us something. So yeah, why should and why can the path integral serve as the basis for quantum theory, and specifically quantum gravity? So the meeting so far has been focused mainly on the mathematics of the gravitational path integral. But my aim this morning is to put the path integral in a larger context, as the title indicates. I will claim that the path integral is not just a propagator, as it's often viewed, but something that can stand on its own two feet as a complete foundation for quantum theories. And when it does so, it will provide the form of quantum mechanics that gravity needs. Hi. Now, to go beyond the conception of the path integral as a propagator, one needs to work with something called the quantum measure, which is defined via something else called the double path integral, which I will describe. In relation to gravity, the definition of the double path integral raises some important questions, which have been neglected, in my view, and I'll mention those too. I also want to, of course, show the path integral in action as an approach to quantum gravity. Of course, we've seen that some aspects of that already, many, but I want to describe a few applications which have hardly been mentioned so far and which I believe are ripe for further work. So unfortunately, all of this amounts to two or maybe even three overlapping talks. So I have to apologize in advance for touching on so many things without much explanation, or in several cases without any explanation. So hopefully, in the latter cases, it can at least provoke some further discussion and questions. And if I get that far, I'll conclude with a list of questions that can offer a basis for further discussion and, I hope, work. Now that quantum gravity, what have I done? I want to say a few words about why I'm saying that quantum gravity needs the path integral. And here I won't even put the periods. So quantum gravity needs pi. And quantum foundations might too, although I'll hardly touch on that today. But in other contexts, the path integral in ordinary quantum mechanics, by ordinary quantum mechanics, I mean things like the Schrodinger equation and so on. In other contexts, ordinary quantum mechanics might be equivalent to the path integral, but arguably this is not the case in gravity. One salient example of this, which I'll be returning to, is topology change. As far as I'm aware, it's not possible to discuss topology change outside of the context of the path integral. And of course, a lot of what we've seen yesterday is a particular case of topology change, a transition from nothing to something, if you like. The Hamiltonian approach, on the other hand, goes against, as I think most people will accept, goes against the spirit of relativity. But as a consequence of that, I would say, it brings conceptual problems, which are not just spiritual, but technical, the so-called problems of time. How do we, in a Hamiltonian formulation using a wave function of the universe, how do we recover time? How, also an equally important question, how do we access meaningful observables? For example, observables relating to black holes, which are globally defined and not recognizable in terms of initial data on a hypersurface. The path integral, on the other hand, has time inherently because it deals with space-times, histories. And so, in principle at least, there's no difficulty in identifying a horizon or any other global feature of gravity. To say this another way, the observables, quote unquote, of gravity are diffeomorphism invariant, and this makes them much more suited to a path integral approach than to a canonical approach. I claim that in the path integral approach, one can identify a large class of observables based on some ideas that I'll just allude to coming from causal sets, which are called stem events. This may have a little meaning, little more meaning later when I define event anyway. So the other thing is that a path integral used in the way that I'm going to use it in what we call quantum measure theory can also help with the interpretation of quantum mechanics because it tells us what reality is like. It's not like a wave function, so we don't get forced into many worlds kind of, I was going to say blind alleys, but that would be too harsh for something that I don't understand, so, which is many worlds. So I will only say, however, a tiny bit more about this. It's a work in progress. And then finally, a small thing, but it's often urged against the path integral, that it does violence to transformation theory, which is supposed to be one of the beautiful and deep aspects of quantum theory. So I'd like to answer that just briefly in two ways, although I don't think it's a key point. First of all, I think in most any version of gravity, quantum gravity, this transformation theory is essentially lost. But on the other hand, I want to claim that in a certain sense, we can recover transformation theory from quantum measure theory because we are able to recover the quantum mechanical Hilbert space in a way that I'll describe. And once you have the Hilbert space, you have some sort of invariance of the quantum measure, actually, under arbitrary unitary transformations. Okay. So in making this kind of claims, it's good, I think, it's always nice to go back and give a little historical background of where the path integral came from in the first place. Now, I say history, what I really mean is some published papers. As I know from some bitter experience, what's published is not always a correct representation of the real history. However, it's the most easily accessible, so I'm going to stick with that. And I want to refer specifically to three papers. One is a little book and two papers, one of which is very well known. The first one is a paper, a little book, a collection of lectures by Heisenberg, which he gave, I think, around 1930 or something at the University of Chicago. And he talks, he almost points to the path integral, not quite. I won't go into any detail just to save time, but he talks about states and he points out that the difference between quantum theory and classical theory is that in certain situations with fixed initial and final states, sort of B1, B2, initial state A, final state B, and many ways of getting from A to C, final state C, anyway, many ways of getting from A to C, that classically the probabilities of these alternatives add, whereas quantum mechanically it's the amplitudes of those that add. And then he has an interesting statement which says, I'll quote it, When stated in a sufficiently generalized form, this distinction is the center of the whole quantum theory. So that's at least pointing a hint at a path integral, or what I'll call the single path integral for reasons that will become clear when I talk about the double path integral. The second paper I want to refer to is, I think, more well known, is a paper by Dirac, in which he actually defines the path integral, at least the single path integral, although he more or less treats it as a propagator. Not quite, because he goes on to something that he calls a generalized transformation function, which is kind of a souped up or more general, as the name says, form of propagator in which the initial and final hypersurfaces can merge, and you just have a space-time region with a boundary. And there's a story that Yukawa used to begin many of his lectures by drawing this circle and saying, our job, this is the GTF, the generalized transformation function, and our job in quantum field theory is to define it. But in the end, it got broken up like this, an initial and a final hypersurface. And I think that was what Tomonaga used in his work that led to the renormalization. So there's a peculiar thing that Dirac says, but if someone asks me afterwards, it just seems wrong, but it doesn't affect the essence of the paper. So if someone is curious, ask me afterwards. And then the third paper that I want to refer to as the most well-known in connection with the path integral, which is that of Feynman. And it's interesting that if you read the paper, and also if you would have spoken to him, implicitly, he wishes to dispense with the wave function altogether and with formulas like trace rho A and so on, observable expectation values, but it remains kind of implicit in the paper. Most of the formal, the mathematical development is actually tied, by and large, to a propagator interpretation of the path integral. But what's, for my purposes today, what's interesting is that he starts off by considering an event that he, I think he calls it an event, but I'll call it an event, which is the event, a space-time event that he considers a particle, and he's the event that the particle's world line lies within a space-time region R. So he has a picture like there's a space-time region R, there's just one particle, and the particle can either lie within R or not lie within R, and the event one is interested in is that it does lie within R. And then he imagines, he goes farther, and he imagines an ideal, what he calls an ideal measurement for this event. By ideal, he means it's some sort of thing that you can imagine that learns the answer but doesn't learn any extra information. And he postulates, his first postulate, that the probability of the event E, I call the event E sub R, the event that he's talking about, he postulates that it's some sort of amplitude associated with the event squared, where A is the sum of some amplitudes of the individual histories. I'll call the histories gamma, the individual histories that enter into the in the event. In other words, the histories, oh, which of course is equal, and A, of course, is equal to E to the, he says, E to the IS of gamma.
Sorry, who is this?
This is Feynman. This is Feynman's paper on the sort of first one on the path integral. Then he says that if an ideal, this is again a quote, if an ideal measurement is performed to determine whether a particle has a path lying in a region of space-time, then the probability that the result will be affirmative is the absolute square of a sum of complex amplitudes, one from each path in the region. And then he goes on to say what the amplitude is, and it's this familiar E to the IS. Very good question. That's my net. Yeah. So it's not made entirely clear in the paper. So that Neil's question is the next question that I wanted to ask. What exactly did he mean by lying within R? If he meant that the entire world line lies within R, that's clearly impossible unless R were to be some region that extended from the beginning of time to the end of time. By the way, he considers an initial and a final time. for this experiment, which I'll come back to that. So if he meant that, then that's impossible. If he meant that, he might have meant something else. He might have meant something a little weaker, that it, at each moment of time in which this reason, region is present, that the path lies within its intersection with the region, the time slice with the region. That, of course, so this one wouldn't qualify because it didn't quite make it here. If that were the interpretation, then then what he's talking about is an ideal space-time measurement. He's trying to stress the space-time aspect would be really no more than a sequence of position measurements. Is it in this region at this time, then this region? This, so I feel that that's maybe not what he had in mind. But even if that were what he had in mind, the formula is still not quite right, as I'll illustrate later. The reason is that probabilities are, in general, not just sums, just squares of sums of amplitudes, but they're sums of squares of sums of amplitudes. Well, something like this. I'm not telling you anything that you don't know. It just may sound a little unfamiliar. This is a question of summing over final states. So the other interpretation that's more in line with the space-time view is that he really just meant that it meets the region R. It doesn't have to always be at every moment of time within R when R exists. Now, those kind of events are precisely the ones of interest to gravity. I'll call them temporally extended events because to know whether or not they happen, it's not enough to know what's going on just at any finite, it's not a succession of questions each pertaining to a finite time in the way that it would have been with those lines that I drew, those orange lines.
Did he give up in the end? Because he says someplace in there that he's never been able to figure out what an ideal measurement of being an R is.
In the end, I don't know, not in this paper. And he does say in this paper that he doesn't, he's not, yeah, he said, I've not been able to come up with a precise definition of an ideal measurement. Yeah, he does definitely say that. Just as a side comment, which I was going to make later, but I'll make in answer to a question. We've recently considered the same question, and it turns out a Psi student here did a project, Alvaro Mosota, and he actually found a way, a measurement scheme that comes as close as it possibly could to what Feynman was asking for. It can't, for reasons I'll say in a second, it can't literally do that, but it comes very, very close in such a way that it allows you to measure the measure of this event. I haven't yet defined the quantum measure of this event, but it's the generalized probability associated with this event. So if we adopt this more general, I claim, if you think about it, that these temporally extended events, also known as inhomogeneous histories in some circles, are exactly the ones that quantum gravity needs, because questions about quantum gravity viewables or observables are always extended in time. They're space-time questions and almost never questions at a moment and a particular slice. Because that's not diffeomorphism invariant. So if we adopt this interpretation, then his first postulate is actually wrong for another reason, and that's because for these extended in time events, if you define the total amplitude this way, it can exceed one easily because of constructive interference, and therefore it's not possible that its square could be a probability because it exceeds one. That's why Alvaro's procedure can't quite do what Feynman is asking for. There's also a third problem which Feynman does point out, which is that he is limited in this discussion. We've limited the range of time to some finite range where this capital T is somehow the end of the experiment, as you might think. But of course, cosmology is not an experiment, at least not an experiment of ours. And we cannot artificially limit the final time. So if we try to overcome these problems and limitations that I've just tried to bring out, then we arrive at something called the double pass integral and a generalized notion of measure in the sense of probability measure that I will describe in a bit. In fact, it's not very obscure what you arrive at. I claim that everyone who thinks about this question of how to write a path integral for a probability and not just for a transition amplitude will arrive at the same formula. For some people, it's familiar under the name of ABL formula. I don't see a lot of whatever the expressions of recognition. ABL, Aharonov, Bergman, and Leibovitz. Peter Bergman. Yeah, it's in his book. And it's actually to be found in other places in a very interesting article by Schwinger, which he talks about the meaning of quantum mechanics. But in any case, I'll show you the formula. In fact, it's there on the board if you want to look ahead. So I was going to say that there is this something very like the ideal measurement, in fact, but I just said that in answer to Jim's question. So before getting to what is double path integral and the quantum measure, let me just try and convince you a little bit more why quantum gravity needs the path integral. And as I said, it needs to put the path integral on its feet. In other words, we need some version of the path integral which can stand on its own two feet as a basis for quantum theory without reliance on the other accoutrements of the ordinary quantum mechanics. So why am I saying this? Well, suppose that we could define the path integral fully for gravity, not just semi-classically, but suppose we could define it fully. I mean, personally, I don't think this will be possible without bringing in an underlying discreteness, but then we can still imagine it as an approximation to that. And anyway, supposing that we could define it, what would we do with it? Would we use the path integral? Would we use it as a propagator? Oops, I already used this. Would we use it as a propagator? Well, if we say it's a propagator is like it's shown there, is from some time t equals 0, say, to some time capital T. What times are we talking about in the case of gravity? We don't have background time. So the first question you can ask, if it's a propagator, from when to when is the propagator? But more to the point, technically, and that's a conceptual worry, but there's also a fundamental technical difference between what a propagator could be in gravity and what it is in all other settings. Formally, the path integral propagator would have to be not a unitary propagator, as you're used to, but a projection operator. Now, why is this? This is an old observation, but maybe not so widely known. Why am I saying this? Well, imagine here's a space-time, initial and final hypersurface, and can everyone see this? Yeah, you can see. So imagine we compute a path integral to get you from 0 to 1. So that's this propagator. And so that's P, let's say. And then now say we do another P, so that takes you from 1 to 2. We do this then. So now we have P squared. But this spacetime I've drawn here is diffeomorphic to this spacetime. So if we believe in diffeomorphism invariance, the whole thing that we've done here is also P. So P squared equals P. So the whole space, let's call this region 1, and this whole region 2. So I'm saying region 1 union region 2 is diffeomorphic to region 1 or region 2 and to region 2.
Sorry, is 1 the same tree geometry as 2?
Oh, no. 1 and 0, 1 and 2. So, sorry, we have to sum this So we're treating this as a a propagator, so we have to sum over the intermediate.
Yes.
But so that's saying that the sum of P to 1, sum over 1 of P to 1 times P 1, 0 is equal to P 2, 0, right? This is the definition.
So you consider the all geometries, the sum of all geometries between one geometry, spatial geometry 0, and one spatial geometry 1.
Right.
And you consider that as a matrix element. And then you do the same, another matrix element from 1 to 2. And then again, the last thing is the sum over all geometries from some geometry 0 to some geometry 2. But in all cases, it's always a sum over all geometries which fit into these two spatial geometries. So in all cases, it's the same object. And that's why you do get a projector if you define the quantum gravity integral. And in this way, and an important aspect is, of course, that you don't specify how long these
right, that's an important thing.
You cannot
right.
do that.
Right. If we were to go to a unimodular point of view, which I'll allude to briefly later, it wouldn't be like this anymore because the volumes wouldn't be the same. But in the way that it's usually viewed, and at least at a formal level, this is a projector because this is just the matrix element of the equation that says P squared 2,0 is equal to P 2,0. Okay. Of course, a lot is assumed here. There's what is the measure, tau, is it diffeomorphic, invariant, blah, 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 blah. But at a formal level, anyway, it's a projector. So this is a big difference from the non-gravitational case, at least.
So, Rafi,
this looks a little bit too formal.
Yes, I agree. Everything in quite.
Can you show it for a relativistic particle?
Yeah.
What for a non-relativistic particle?
Well, you mean the parameter? You mean the parameterized?
Yeah.
The parameter?
Yeah.
Well,
that
I.
Yeah, it's easy to talk.
Yeah, sure.
Yes.
It's easy.
Non-relativistic
quantum mechanics, it's easy, but for a relativistic particle,
it's also.
I leave it to the expert. It's also easy.
I can shed some light on that. The many superspace propagators, if you integrate over an infinite Lamps contour, you get exactly delta H, which is a projector onto.
Exactly.
And it's exactly a projector.
Yes.
All Lamps.
So you can actually.
Yeah.
Then
why do you call it propagator?
Well, it's a sum over all. Because the Lamps is just a gauge. I mean. The invariant definition is integrating, like Bianca said, over all four geometries that fit between these two. That's the underlying idea. Then if you slice it up, then you do an integral over the spatial metrics, an integral over the Lamps, and so on.
What's the range of that integral?
Ah, yes. Well, that's, of course, one of the points that's been raised before, although... Claudio didn't jump up and down as much as I thought he might in stressing this, but it's come up, it's been stressed since then, which is that the Lamps should be positive, because if you think what it means to slice up a four geometry like this, then you at least you can slice it up in such a way that the Lamps never goes negative.
So now you're disagreeing with Jonathan.
Yes. Well, it's a question of what.
So let's not bury these differences. Rather, if you can be a bit more explicit, then we will.
I can present some afternoon the case of the non-relativistic particle and the.
Yeah, maybe that's okay. That sounds very good.
So you say with positive Lamps for the relativistic particle, you get a composition rule like this.
You do get a compositional rule, but this is a propagator, and that what Claudio presented is also gauge fixing. So you. If you want to get the projector, you have to integrate over both Lamps.
Mean negative. Oh, if you want it to be a projector.
I mean,
right, right.
Projector is more than a composition.
Wait, if you want it to be a projector. No, wait.
Disagreeing with me. Anchors.
Not exactly. So I'm weaseling in vitro. No, no, no. This is only preamble. I want to say that formally it's a projector, but, okay, but it's not formally a projector onto solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which I would have said had I had a chance to to get beyond this. But the word formally is actually crucial here, right? I'm not claiming anything at a technical level. That's a very interesting enterprise, and people have worked on that, but I'm not taking a stand on that. But formally it is a projector. And as far as I can see, because of this lapse issue, it's not a projector onto solution. This is going to be, at the end, I'm going to list some questions, as I said, or if I said, did I actually say? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so at the end, I'm going to give the list of questions. And one of them is exactly this. Is it a projector? And if so, onto what? So the technical question here is, which I'll repeat at the end, is it a projector? And if it is, does it produce a solution of the Hamiltonian constraint? In other words, does it produce a solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation? And my point of view is that of Claudio. I mean, I'm convinced by that argument that it does not produce a solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. I should stress that my point of view is always the space-time one. I'm always thinking of a path integral, not in terms of canonical variables necessarily or gauge fixing, but just a sum over four geometries. However, this was all meant just as a sort of polemic against thinking of the path integral simply as a propagator. When we look away from the propagator and think more generally, more globally, I'm sorry, as in the case of the kind of space-time events that Feynman was talking about, then then it turns out that the path integral, and especially the double path integral, which I'm about to describe, appears more like a generalization of a Brownian motion or stochastic process than it does of Hamiltonian mechanics. It's naturally described in terms of a generalization of measure theory, and this is what I want to turn to next. So in measure theory, and in particular in the kind of generalized measure theory that I am now talking about, we have a history space, which I'll call omega, the space of all histories. And we have an event algebra, which I won't give a name to because I won't really need it. But it's the set of all events for the kind of system in question. Now, what is a history and what is an event? So Faye Dauker, I think history is not that mysterious, but Faye Dauker has a nice definition of a history, which is a history is a particular detailed way in which an event can happen. So for gravitational path integral, for example, there's a confusion here. What I call history here is what some people call fine-grained history. Not coarse-grained history. So a history is a particular detailed way in which an event can happen. For the gravitational path integral case, the history is just a four geometry. Or to put it another way, the histories are what the path integral integrates over. An event, then, is just a set of histories. So here's a history, and then the event of meeting this region R, it just consists of all the histories like this, and the complementary event consists of all the histories like this, and the union is, they're disjoint, and the union is the whole history space, omega. I don't actually think I'll even need.
But in your story that a history is a way for an event to happen, does that mean each history has a preferred event?
No, there's no one to, no, not okay, at all.
Thank you.
Event is just nothing but a set of histories. And if one isn't worrying about technical niceties, any set of histories will do. But in measure theory, you know, the Wiener process, there's so-called measurable sets, and you blah, blah, blah.
And, okay. Also, you're kind of redefining event. It's not a space-time point.
Oh, that's a very good point.
Fine.
Thank you. Yes.
That's fine, but I want to kind of understand how far that extension goes. Is it only these extended regions, or can they be disconnected?
Well, yeah, what I should have mentioned that too. What we call event, sometimes people mean a point event, mean a point of space-time. That's a common usage. The usage I'm using is the one that's universal in probability theory, where they talk about a sample space, which is this, in this case, the history space, and an event is a subset of the sample space. So this actually corresponds. So you could think of a space-time event as just some sort of limiting case, a space-time point, but I'm not going there. But I mean, that's, in a sense, the relation between the two. This notion of event corresponds to the everyday meaning of events.
Okay. But you're happy for these events to be disconnected regions?
Oh, absolutely. And they don't have to be defined exactly in this way. Any way of defining a set of histories
okay.
that's of interest will give an event. Like we can talk about the history of all the events in which the universe bounces, right?
Yeah.
So that's not, there's no background space-time, no regions, but it's just some property that a particular history can have or not have.
Okay. Would you agree with the idea that there's a fine-grained set, namely the Feynman patterns, and that the other histories are partitions of those into classes?
Yeah, those I would call events. Those other histories is what I'm calling events. One of those class, not a partition, but a particular class in the partition is what I'm calling an event.
Yes, okay.
Sorry, why do you call it an algebra?
Oh, because it's a Boolean algebra. So it's in fancy mathematics, it's a sigma algebra, actually. So given any two events, which are just subsets, you can combine them with and, or, not. In other words, you can take their intersection, their union, their complement, and then in measure theory, you allow yourself to take an infinite but countable union or an infinite but countable intersection. And that if it's closed under all of those operations, it's called a sigma algebra. Otherwise, it's just an algebra. I'm not bothered with the fine distinctions in this talk.
So just one point out, as an advertisement for my talk in the afternoon, there'll be more on this.
Oh, right. Yes, that's right. And there's going to be more. Oh, good. OK, so that's my excuse. And I'm going to leave out another thing I was going to say, precisely because it's going to be in your talk. As I'll mention. So what is the form? So what does the quantum measure do for us? It gives us, for any event, it gives us a positive real number, which we call the measure of the event, mu of e. And this is the definition of it, which is, if you like, this ABL formula in disguise, not in disguise, but in this particular, I mean, I think this is the more natural way. I think that's this in disguise, I should probably say. But it's just double, the important thing is it's a double sum over two sets of histories, one in the event, both required to lie in the event E, of some amplitude, which jointly depends on the two histories. What is this amplitude? It's D because it's known as decoherence functional, or it's a special case of what's known as decoherence functional. It's the amplitude of the first history times the amplitude of the second history complex conjugate times a kind of final delta function which sews the two histories together at the final time, which I'm calling the truncation time. And the individual amplitudes are the e to the is plus an initial amplitude that gets the path started at t equals 0, which I call psi 0, and corresponds to an initial wave function. Yes.
So this is maybe just a mathematical point, but if in models, in quantum field theory models, where the path integral can actually be rigorously defined, the correlation functions are not usually the moments of a measure. So this measure really is a little bit of an illusion. There is a characterization when some moments, some endpoint functions are the moments of a measure, and that criterion is just not satisfied usually. So you're maybe a bit misled by the Wiener process, which is sort of the quantum mechanical.
Well, I think I'll refer you to Sumaji's talk. It's in fact true that this doesn't satisfy the definition of a complex measure. And an interesting mathematical question is, what is the right framework? Maybe you say that quantum field theory has an answer for us.
The correlation functions are defined, but they're not the moments of a measure. That's
right. So what are they? Okay. So let's
what
say.
What do they look like?
Yeah. Okay. I agree. Okay. So I want to say a little bit more about this, but I want to jump ahead because I want to get to gravity actually. So this. Just repeat what I said before, that this expression, and this is a key point, this expression here follows immediately if you ask for a formula for the probability of a sequence of position measurements, the kind of boring, not so space-time events that that I referred to earlier. Therefore, because we can regard the outcomes of measurements as encoded in position information, this mu of E directly, and this is, I want to stress this, it directly reproduces the probabilities of measurements, the probability of instrument events, if we believe the usual hand-waving arguments that we can move the quantum classical cut as far as we want in the direction, the larger direction. So in other words, if we can believe that we could include the measurement apparatus in the system and get the same probability, then this directly says that the results of all measurement probabilities are expressed by this double path integral.
So I
saw your hand, just let me say. And even if we don't believe this cut argument, if we're willing to use a model of a measuring instrument that's some very simple, small particle-like thing and so on, that's not truly macroscopic, then the same result follows. Yeah, go on.
So the delta in D is what makes gamma and gamma prime decohere here?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. It shows which pairs, this delta shows which pairs of histories can interfere
right, so
and which one cannot interfere.
Right,
and
so how is that compatible with your definition of gamma as a fine-grained history?
Why not?
Because fine-grained histories typically don't decohere.
I didn't say decohere, interfere. Which ones can cohere, so to speak? In fact, this was named, it should have been called the coherence functional. I noticed that Jim didn't call it, he had some other nice way of.
Well, okay, is it the same D as Jim's D or not?
What?
Is it the same D as your D or not?
Yes, well, essentially, yes.
Yeah, it's got this delta on the outside. Yes, I mean, I defined it as a sum, so I'm a little. It's not automatically the decoherence function is not automatic.
There's no claim about decoherence here.
Right.
I'm just defining a number which I can associate to any event.
So it's not.
And I'm saying that it gives, if you apply it to instrument events, yeah, it directly gives you the probability of that outcome. I'd say it's mathematically the same object, but the way in which it's being used is rather different.
Okay. Delta functions in finite time.
Why
the
histories have
delta
to
functions
agree
on the time?
Yes.
These gamma and gamma prime
I have a picture, so let's see. Where are we?
But they do interfere, sure.
I was going to do this later, but I can try. So I didn't want to go into too much detail, but where did I put this? Not here, is it?
Oh,
no, it's. I did draw it. It's probably here. Okay, yes, it's here. So let's consider an experiment in which a particle, say a photon, comes here. It goes through some beam, encounters some beam splitters. It emerges either on port one, or in beam one, in beam two, or in beam three. And let's consider the event, which I called here D, which is that the particle actually passes through this beam. We could imagine, just to fix ideas, that we put a detector here that'll determine whether or not, like those detectors that ruin the two-slit interference. Okay. So what would be the probability of this detector signaling something? So you have to compute, this is what I'm calling the measure of that event, all the histories that go by the upper beam. Well, if you compute this, I mean, you can convince yourself that the answer is the sum of the squared amplitude to arrive at 1 plus the squared amplitude to arrive at 2, plus the squared amplitude to arrive at 3. In other words, this is the answer, the measure of D. It is not the amplitude to derive at 1 plus the amplitude to arrive at 2 plus the amplitude to arrive at 3 squared. That would just give the wrong answer. Now that, so what does that mean? It means that the part of, if I sort of stop the experiment here, it means that the histories which have different final outcomes don't interfere with each other. If you took the, in fact, Heisenberg points out this following point, that if I took, and it's been mentioned many times since that, if I took this sum and introduced a random phase into the, instead of just a plus sign, but a random phase relating them, and averaged over the random phases, it would go back to this one. So that the idea of measurement as a random disturbance in the phase shows you how to get back from the quantum formula to the classical formula. Okay, but
how can it go to 2 and to D? Is
there
like a
another did I? Oh, yeah. That's a very good question. Yes. It's too early in the morning when I was drawing this. Yes, there's a beam splitter at every corner except here. This is a solid mirror. Yeah, so it can go here and bounce off. And go. And if you wanted to work out the numbers just for fun, the amplitude, a beam splitter has the property that the amplitude to go through is 1, and the amplitude to bounce off is I. By choice of phase, you can always make it have this property, if it's a 50-50 beam splitter. Okay. Was there no, so quantum, yeah, so quantum, so I call mu of E, if I haven't said this before, the quantum measure. I also want to just briefly mention that this double path integral arises naturally, completely naturally, if you try to describe open systems rather than closed systems. And in fact, the correction to the unitary closed system formula is given under certain circumstances, just harmonic oscillators, blah, 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 by something called the Feynman-Vernon influence functional, which is an early application of these path integral methods that lead precisely to a formula like this. What's called the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism for thermal field theory is also precisely in this setting. And again, it makes sense because thermal field theory is really a theory of an open system. So let me just say a couple of words. A couple of words about the quantum measure. Just one thing, I think, for the future. I'll skip the other stuff. But I want to stress that there's this final time, and this was something Feynman himself complained about in that paper. We don't really want to do that. The claim here is that it just looks like it's there. It really drops out. If we look at sort of Wiener process, Brownian, the theory of Brownian motion, there's no such final time. They often put an initial time, but you can ask something, did the particle ever return to the origin? You don't have to say when. You don't have to say, we stopped the experiment at this time. You just ask, did that event ever happen, the event of return to the origin? This looks like it's tied to a final time, but in fact, it's not. If we write this formula for a unitary system, unitary theory, then one can show that the final time drops out, that you can push it arbitrarily far to the future. And this will come back as a question about the gravitational case. The other things I wanted to say, I think I'll skip, about the recovery of the Hilbert space. Just mention that this D satisfies a condition called strong positivity. Which I won't now define. Well, I can say it in words. It's as a matrix, it's positive semi-definite. Then you recover the usual Hilbert space from this formalism without having put it in. And that allows you, the rest we'll hear, I think, from Sumati's talk about how that goes, I think, maybe. So let me skip ahead. Just allude to, give a bow to, a question which I'm evading here, which is that in this whole framework, it's the question of foundations. In this framework, what counts as a possible reality? Is it a single history or something more complicated? So the answer is, we're working on it, but we don't have the answer yet. But we do have a name for it. So the name is a co-event. A co-event is meant to be something like a history, but not quite. We also have an interpretive principle, which is, I'll come back again which in the talk, which is preclusion, which is that if mu equals zero, so this is called preclusion, if mu equals zero, then E cannot happen. Okay, that's preclusion. With that, I'll leave questions of interpretation and foundation mainly. So, because I want to try and connect these things up with quantum gravity. Yeah.
So, how do you define reality?
I'm not defining reality. I mean, it'll be a co-event, but I haven't told you that I can give you a preliminary definition. A polynomial in the histories, will that work for you? With coefficients in Z2? Okay, never mind. I mean, that's not entirely a joke, but I don't mean it to be taken too seriously either. Why were you laughing? Did you had a question?
Yeah, so you connected shortly to Aronoff's work. I was wondering what the relation is of this formalism you set up with weak values?
So far, none. At some point, I thought there was a relation. Well, there's a similar spirit going on, but there's no precise relationship. And I haven't told you. If I showed you Alvaro's technique for measuring the quantum measure, that is setting up an experiment that can determine, actually, and these I hope will be done soon in an optics lab, actually an experiment that can determine this, then you would see to what extent there's a connection and what extent there's not. Okay, so I wanted to, before getting to gravity, I wanted to say something about some technical problems with that the path into which you already alluded to. Technical problems with the path integral, but I'm going to skip over that with a reference to Sumati's talk, in which at least the first problem, there were two problems that I had in mind. The first I'm calling the failure of the Karateodori-Kolmogorov extension theorem, which fails already for non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Which is that which allows you to extend it allows you to define mu of E for a sufficiently large class, a very large class of events, the whole sigma. Anyway, that's a technical issue. The other technical issue that I wanted to mention, however, maybe is not so well known, or maybe it's not even an issue, I'm not sure, but it seems to me as an issue, and it's related to some of the things that have come up in the conference. So I do want to mention it, and that is, do the histories which are, it has to do with a classical limit. In Dirac's paper, that's how he kind of introduced the path integral, to show that if you do the integral, that it's the paths near the classical path that give the main contribution. And this came up a lot in, for example, in Neil's talk also, that somehow all the contribution is coming from the classical path or nearby paths. However, there's a problem of order of integration, right? These are not absolutely convergent. These are just marginally convergent, or whatever the word is, these kind of Fresnel integrals. And whether or not the contribution, whether the integral really is defined a priori by taking limits, or whether it has to be by some sort of deformation into the complex, is an interesting question. So I just want to give an example to show why there might be a problem here. And the example shows up already for a Fresnel integral in three dimensions. Suppose we're just integrating over R3 of dx e to the I x dot x, so even three. Of course, in the K cases of interest, this three is really infinite. We're dealing integrating over all paths. But you can already see in dimension three, if, so let me draw it as in two. If you do the integration in the order, first the x direction, let's say, and then the y direction, then the first, the x, you'll say, oh, most of the contribution comes from the y-axis. Then you do the integral over the y, and you'll say, most of the contribution comes from the origin, which is what we wanted, right? Most of the contribution to this comes from the origin. That's the classical path, the extremum of this x squared. However, suppose we divide it up another way. Suppose we divide it up as spheres like this. That seems quite reasonable. Do the angular integral first, and then do the integral over r, right? So there's two choices, dx and then dy, or d theta and then dr. If you, this, it looks two-dimensional, but I mean it to be three. True. This is theta.
This is.
And z is, I can do that. If you make me think whether I need a sine omega, sine theta.
What?
D omega, okay.
Yeah,
D2 omega, okay. Yeah, no, let's not be too accurate here. This is all stream of consciousness. What you'll find if you do it here is that the answer as a function of r, of the partial integral, actually oscillates, but it doesn't settle down to an answer. It oscillates more and more and more as you go up in r, and it doesn't, you can't even define the integral as a limit taken in this way. So I just want to say there's a, all, the only moral I draw from this is that it's not so easy to understand the classical limit as it might seem, and we need to understand it better. But that, okay, now let me get finally to gravity. So what I want to ask here is what, so I've talked a lot in favor of the path integral, but what can the path integral do for us, us being interested in quantum gravity, and vice versa.
Can I just make a quick remark on your previous point about the semi-classical limit, and I'm curious about your opinion. When properly formulated, this thing you're saying doesn't arise. That is, if you take into account, for example, the integral of the sum of p dot dq, that form is invariant under canonical transformation. So when you write these things,
I'm not talking about canonical. I don't understand.
But what I'm trying to say is that if you're really talking about semi-classical limit of physics in phase space, then these things are invariant under canonical.
I'm not talking in phase space. I'm talking in the history space.
I know, but I'm saying that there.
You're saying we can overcome this by some device.
We should be able to. Otherwise, the formulation is messed up, right?
Well, that's why. Yeah, I mean, let's talk about it later. But okay. I'm not convinced. Basically, you're dealing with an integral like this, a marginally convergent integral, and I'm not convinced that that goes away just because you go to a phase space formulation. Okay, so it's coming to gravity. So I will treat this entirely under the assumption that we're dealing with a continuum theory, although, as I said more than once, I think ultimately it needs to be discrete, but actually Neil has forbidden me from saying anything about discrete theories, which I'm just I'm just sneaking in a couple of reference.
No, I said you have to be indiscreet.
Indiscreet. Yes, it's not so hard. So I will not say more. I will just stay in the framework of the continuum. And in that framework, the first question that arises, of course, has come up before. Do we want an integral over Lorentzian spacetimes, that is real spacetimes, or some sort of Euclidean, or something in between, maybe? Now, since I wasn't allowed to refer to causal set, let me say that the causal set gives me a very strong reason to think that we need Euclidean. We don't. Say that we need Lorentzian. Need Lorentzian because Euclidean can't come out of a causal set. But there are other considerations. The most obvious is, why should we suddenly treat time as imaginary just because we're doing gravity? A more practical consideration, which has come up a lot, is that if we start from the Lorentzian path integral, then at least in principle, everything is uniquely determined. And we saw this very clearly in some of the talks yesterday. For example, what we saw particularly was that a particular saddle point is either valid for a semi-classical approximation or it is not. You can use something fancy like Picard-Lefschetz, or you can use something not so fancy, just looking at where you can rotate the contour and follow the usual rules that you'll find in any textbook of complex variables. So those are advantages, but I'm not claiming that they're decisive. But for the rest of the talk, that is going to be my assumption, that everything is fundamentally defined as a Lorentzian path integral. And then the use of any other signature has the status of a computational device. I'll come back to illustrate something about that in a little bit when we talk about tunneling. So where am I going to put all this? This we don't need anymore. Okay, so when we come to define the gravitational path integral, an important question is, what takes the place, if anything, of this interaction term? This is what I mean by interaction term, because it couples the two histories together. What takes the place of that interaction term between, it'll now be G and G prime, when G and G prime are four geometries? First of all, we could ask, what plays the role of the truncation time, the final time here? Should it be a space-like hypersurface, like the picture that we have here, some sort of final hypersurface? That would be kind of the default assumption, I think. Should it be like a final hypersurface sigma? Or perhaps it should be, maybe it's more natural from some points of view to consider a null surface. So sigma could be, even like the past of a single point event, would be maybe a natural, if you kind of think of an observer sitting here, that's one way of motivating this idea. Anyway, it's one possibility. And just a couple of comments. As with the single path integral, this one here, we need a surface term if we want the classical limit to come out right for the quantum measure for quantum gravity. So I just want to make a couple of remarks on the null surface, because again, not so widely known things. If part or all of this surface sigma is null, then the surface term is not gauge invariant that you have to add. And if there's a null and a space-like portion, when they meet, there are further non-invariant corner terms that come in. However, all these ambiguities drop out from the double path integral, because when you look how the sum of the two actions are put together, these ambiguities drop out. So that's an interesting thing. I think it's a sort of technical or slightly conceptual advantage of the double path integral. By the same token, and in a similar way, the double path integral clarifies how Galilean invariance works. You might know there's a wave function transform in a funny way. But if you work with this double path integral, you see that it's actually invariant. And similar cases like gauge invariance of Chern-Simons action, something similar happens. So you might say, in this sense, that the double path integral is more manifestly gauge invariant than the single path integral. This means single path integral, and this, the double path, the one that acts like a propagator in DPI means double. Another question that comes up in the case of a null hypersurface is how to choose the initial data. But let me not say very much more about that, just other than that you might think you need half the Cauchy data. And this raises a very interesting question of what counts as half of the Cauchy data on a null hypersurface, where just the induced metric already determines also its normal derivative, because in a null hypersurface, the normal is in the surface. Okay. So those are questions about, I think, interesting questions about how to set up the gravitational path integral, double path integral. But let me go to things that you might regard as more applications, sort of the path integral at work, or the path integral in action. So I want to, there's several topics here that I'm going to have to rush through, I'm afraid. But the first three of them have to do with topology change, which I highlighted earlier as one of the arenas of application, where the path integral seems to be the only thing of the only game in town, right, as people say. Only the path integral seems able to handle topology change. So the three applications are to topological geons, which I'll start with, to the birth of the universe and related topological, and then third to related topological transitions, specifically in one plus one dimensions or two space-time dimensions. So let me start with the topological geons. So what is a topological geon? Topological geon, I should add, because there's another use of the word, which is not this. They're closely analogous to skirmions, for those who know what skirmions are. What they are is particle-like excitations of the spatial topology, which in the individual excitation in 3 plus 1 dimensions corresponds to what's called a prime manifold, kind of an irreducible bit of topology. Now, in pure gravity without topology change, there's a theorem involves unitary irreducible representations of semi-direct product groups, blah, blah, blah. That was Tsumati's thesis, in fact, that classifies the geons in terms of quantum numbers that have a physical meaning. One is their internal symmetry type. Another one is their spin type. In other words, whether they're tensorial or spinorial, by which I mean, do they have half integer spin or integer spin? Spinorial means half integer spin. And also their behavior under permutations, which is their statistics, permutation of identical geons, and then actually under a novel set of quantum numbers that come into play in collisions of geons that we've always thought might have nice condensed matter realizations with things like vortex rings and so on. But so far, I don't know of any such actual case. So in particular, geons can be quantized as bosons or as fermions. We're talking about pure gravity, but you can get fermions out. Or they can actually exhibit other entirely novel statistical types. Likewise, they can be spinorial or tensorial. However, if you freeze the topology, if you take just a space-time of the form R cross some free manifold, which may have a certain number of geons built into it, then the correlation between spin and statistics fails. So this is where the path integral comes. So far, nothing I said has too much to do with the path integral, although it can be expressed in that language. But in a path integral description, geon spin and statistics are coded into how the amplitude of the double history, the Schwinger history, I call this, I'll call it the Schwinger history, how the amplitude of the Schwinger history, that D of gamma gamma prime, depends on its four-dimensional topology. It also provides an interesting way to look at particle statistics just in ordinary quantum mechanics. The main point, however, is that with the gravitational path integral, pair creation becomes possible because the geons are topological things. Pair creation demands topology change. And it becomes possible, and if one adopts certain rules about how the amplitudes transform, when one modifies the topology of the Schwinger history in certain ways, I'll try to be more vague in the next thing. then one recovers the spin statistics correlation. Conversely, this fact provides hints as to what general conditions govern the entry of different topological types into the path integral. And if we stick to the continuum, then I think we sorely need such rules, because otherwise you're left with, I think Jim referred to, a sum over topologies, and that's a horrible, almost uncontrollable sum, unless there's some rules. So, okay, so that's what we might learn by thinking about spin statistics and geons, but at least quite a lot is known, as I described in that theorem already, at a sort of quasi-kinematical level.
We have about sum over topologies sort of automatically. I shouldn't have interrupted.
Okay. I didn't quite hear what you said. Something realizes it automatically?
Yeah,
The path integral realizes it automatically, but still to mathematically take it into account is,
right.
I think you wrote a paper with Bob Garrett pointing out how difficult it is to actually. I'm just saying what we would like is
a slightly different focus. What if physics predicted non-computable numbers?
Right.
Some of the topologies
is an example. Okay, the second example is the birth of the second example of topology chain. So this was topology chains. One, topological geons. Two is the birth or the death of the cosmos. We mainly talked about the birth by tunneling. This has been heavily talked about already, but I want to make a few points which, in connection with this, what is this? Of course, most of the work has been semi-classical, and in that context, people have debated which saddle point is the right saddle point. For the Friedman cosmos, by which I mean S3, so here is that, it's up there, yeah. So I mean that the topology is S3 cross R, just a closed spherical universe. For the Friedman cosmos and pure gravity, the problem is mathematically the same as alpha decay by tunneling at fixed energy, where the lambda plays the role of the energy. And the result, if you treat it that way, to classical order, I say classical, not semi-classical, because I'm ignoring the prefactor, the analog of the Van Vleck-Morat determinant that we heard about the other day. So to classical order, just looking at the exponential, I didn't write it down. What is it, 12 pi squared over lambda? But we saw it before. The result goes as e to the minus 12 pi squared over lambda, with the minus sign, of course, being the contentious point. The only thing I want to say in connection with this is that you can use any mathematical device to evaluate this that you like. It doesn't have to be a Wick rotation. It doesn't have to be a deformation of the contour into the complex. Something as simple, I'm thinking now of the tunneling case of a non-relativistic particle, but they're mathematically identical. It can be something as simple as analytically continuing in the mass. So if this is a number, it's not an infinite dimensional thing, a contour, it's just the mass. If we take the mass to go, I forget which way is the right way, but go from a positive value to a negative value, then you end up doing the path integral over exactly the original set of histories of paths, nothing new. But you find that a single saddle point occurs in the domain of integration. It's a steepest descent saddle point. And so you can just use the usual saddle point, the usual machinery, just to get the answer. However, where is the sign, the choice of sign coming from? It's because you have to be careful that when you analytically continue M, that the result remains a holomorphic function of M, and in particular, that the integral you're trying to do remains well-defined for all the intermediate values of M. And that rules out one way of going around the origin and allows the other way. And that's where the sign, when you analytically continue back, just in this one number, M, that's when you get this result, e to the minus 12 pi squared over lambda. The third application I want to give is the topology change in two dimensions. So it's a little connected with the one we just discussed, bringing in a new possibility, which is the trousers. So here we have a picture for this. So this is two-dimensional topology change. Now, in two-dimensional topology change, in two dimensions, just topologically, just in case of manifolds, three types of, these are called cobordisms, these kind of things. And three types of cobordisms only are possible, and each one is defined by a signature, either plus, 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 minus, minus, or plus, minus. Plus, plus has to do with the birth of a universe or a new section of a cosmos. Minus, minus is the time reverse, and plus, minus is the trousers, which is, if you think of it as a topological transition, it goes from, in this case, one circle to two circles. Okay. Changes the number of connected components of the universe. In higher dimensions, there's far more interesting possibilities, but you don't get them until you come to four dimensions, where the new possibility is of this type. It turns out, but this is just topology. If we want to do a path integral, then we need to put metrics on the top, put a Lorentzian metric on this kind of manifold, these cobordisms. It turns out that there's a natural, arguably a very natural way to do it using what I call a Morse, I'll call here, a Morse metric. There's a metric defined by a Morse function. There's no time to go into detail, but this f is a Morse function, which vanishes at some point, and that can be regarded as the point where the topology actually changed. And if this is a nice metric, you can take the Morse function to be smooth. In fact, typically, you can take it just to be a polynomial. And in two dimensions, here's an example of the resulting metric. Oh, I haven't shown the Morse function, but it's just sum of squares or difference of squares. When you do that for any Morse function and any background Riemannian metric H, this is a well-defined Lorentzian metric, which is smooth everywhere and vanishes at one point, which is where the Morse function itself vanishes. And here's the example in two dimensions of the resulting line element. It's just r squared times the x squared plus dy squared minus, this was 2, we'll take it to be x dx plus or minus y dy squared. The sign here is depends, you know, distinguishes these two cases. The minus sign is for this case, and the plus sign is for those two cases.
I said that there were some people by Ruba, Wolf and company, when they were considered such a topology, they showed that catastrophic production of the particle do not allow you.
Well, that's a very interesting question. So I could say a lot on that, but I'd be interested in that paper. The earliest argument I know of that sort was given by Bryce DeWitt. Yeah, and then we've looked at that, and Anderson and Manog also looked at it. Other people looked at that. Yeah, so
that's a sudden change of boundary conditions.
Yes, exactly,
so
yeah.
You have a thunderbolt coming out from this.
Yes, exactly, from the crotch of the of the trousers. So the only thing I'll say about that is that there's reason to believe that that's special to two dimensions, that will not happen for this signature.
Oh.
And but that's been an open question for a long time, but I strongly recommend it as an interesting question to look at. Because no, it's not two times. It's all Lorentzian. There's a confusion. This signature is.
You mean that this is topology?
It's a kind of topology change in which, in which a kind of a torus shrinks down and then another. Anyway, it's the new interesting kind of topological transition that can happen in 3+1 dimensions. So I'm really getting out of time. So let's see, 10 minutes. Okay, so let me just briefly say, in this case, because the metric is smooth, but the inverse blows up, the Ricci scalar acquires a delta function type singularity, and its contribution to the action is undefined. You can define it by complexifying G slightly and taking a limit, but you need to choose the sign of the imaginary part. And in some work of it on this that Loukko and I did, we had a rule for choosing the sign, and it gave enhancement of this and suppression, but by a finite amount of this one, so not the infinite suppression that Slava was referring to. Only other thing I want, okay, in the context of cosmology, I just want to stress a little bit a point that I think Jim made, well, that's been made for a long time, but he made again yesterday, which is that in doing a cosmological path integral, one doesn't need an initial wave function as such, but one might need an initial choice, a restriction on the histories that go into the integral. And a natural restriction is this, and interestingly enough, if you do this for the case of the birth of the cosmos, you get automatically that it expands from zero size. So it fits very, very nicely with the Hartle-Hawking type, no boundary condition, except that it's fundamentally Lorentzian or almost Lorentzian, because depending whether you want to call G equals zero is Lorentzian, but that happens only at a finite number of points. I won't say anything about bounces. The path integral seems to diverge. I would say very little about that, but I do want to say that there are indications that the path integral, the gravitational path integral does diverge. For example, that the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, Wheeler-DeWitt wave functions are not square integrable. There's another argument, I think it's kind of interesting from semi-classical gravity that I'll skip, but if anyone wants to ask about it later, I'll say. But if it does diverge, then there's the question, so now I have another GPI, the gravitational path integral. If it diverges, will unimodular unimodularity help? By unimodularity, what do I mean by unimodularity? I mean that it's a restriction on the histories that enter into the path integral, in which V plays the role of time. So I'll abbreviate that by saying V equals T, where V means the four volume, not the spatial volume, but the four volume. That's not the way it's always discussed, but that's equivalent, and it brings out very clearly the diffeomorphism invariant nature of this unimodular restriction. That's a restriction, and there are reasons to think, we sort of know that it moderates the divergence, but how much, I'm not sure. I'll refer you to some work that Jorma Loukko and I did on homogeneous cosmologies in the unimodular framework, which forces you, for an interesting reason, to complex saddle points and so on. Okay, so in the remaining 10 minutes or whatever, I just want to list a bunch of questions, most of which have come up one way or another. So already, we just sort of bring them together. Maybe I have a free, no. What is this? So the first one is how the first set relates to gravity, and then there's a few more general. how even formally, this refers to what I said about the unclarity as what plays the role of truncation time, the interaction term, and so on. How even formally can we define the gravitational path? Let's see, GDP, the gravitational double path integral. In particular, and there's a bunch of subsidiary questions which I won't write down, but do we want the unimodular or the unconstrained sum, unlimited sum over all geometries? And there's also the question of what plays the role. I said it, and it's hard to write it in a simple way, but what plays the role, this is related to this, of the final t and of this delta of gamma prime at the time t. And I said some questions about boundary data for a null surface and so on. I just won't bother to write them down again. The second one is an obvious one. So is Lorentzian or Euclidean or something else? And then whatever it is, which is the right sign of the, I won't bother with the 12 pi squared, which sign is the right sign? The third one relates a little bit to the discussion of projection operator. Can unitarity even be defined for gravity? And I'll say in words, so I often ask people and don't get much answers, what experimental bounds do we have on violations of unitarity? Funny that it's hardly asked, I mean, but there is some work on it. Then does the path integral diverge? If so, would the unimodularity help? I won't take the time to write that down. Does it produce solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation or not? If it doesn't, what does it yield? Is it really a projector? And if it's really a projector, onto what space does it project? Since it's now I'm not weaseling anymore. Except, or perhaps it doesn't project on any space, maybe because if we take this 1 over epsilon, sort of epsilon plus IH type of thing that emerges from Claudio's talk, then it seems that all it will do is place some fall-off conditions on the wave function without subjecting it to actual equality, you know, some equations, further equations. Then two more, I'll just say, what can I say about this? The question was going to be, does Picard-Lefschetz really apply to gravity? I had a couple of points, but let me limit myself to just one, which is, what? What is this? Does it really apply to gravity? Why might it not apply? One reason is the signature condition. This came up actually yesterday, and I think it's a comment of Jonathan, that we're integrating only over Lorentzian signatures, so that means the metric is not going from minus infinity to infinity. It's limited to something like more like a half plane or some subset of the space of all metric tensors. Then one has to ask whether the integrand falls off, goes to zero at the appropriate way that Picard-Lefschetz needs, or if it doesn't, then one needs some suitable generalization of Picard-Lefschetz that would work in the more general situation. And then the last one, the last gravitational question is, you can ask me what all this means. Abelian spin aureal prime. This is just a pure mathematical differential topology. Three manifolds, which are nicknamed by mathematicians threefolds. Why is this interesting? It's not to do with the path integral itself, but it makes, if they do exist, it makes the proof of spin statistics coming from path integrals that I mentioned before all the more interesting. But it's a nice mathematical problem, and someone already knows the answer, but we haven't found that person yet. Bill Thurston said, yes, certainly, they must, or something. But he never gave us an exact, explicit form, and now it's too late to ask him. But. And then finally, let me finish with just a couple of questions about the double path integral or quantum measure more generally. I won't even write the next one, but it just, is the title that I gave to the talk really right? I mean, is the promise fulfilled? Can the path integral provide a fully freestanding formulation of quantum mechanics, including its interpretive aspects? But just this one I do want to write because I want to recommend it as an very interesting neglected question, which is can we formulate relativistic, this stands for relativistic causality, say in the context of a fixed background space-time, directly in terms of the path integral? That is, without, what is it about the path integral that makes things behave causally without reference to external agents and signaling and so on? And then the last one, I'll skip, and the next to last one will be my last one. What? I am finished. This is, I have one more to write.
One more.
No, I didn't say one more. One more set of questions. Does the path integral extend naturally to fermion fields? Okay. That's it. That is the last.
Thank you. Millions of questions. I think, in view of coffee, we're going to just take two very short and very focused ones, and then we'll come back. I'm sure all these questions will be addressed later. Very short, very focused.
I'm changing my questions. I was going to try and answer all your questions. Your questions before, but that's not short.
No.
So my question, my revised question is, so I've been sitting in the lecture, right, taking everything you write down and comparing it with what I would call decoherent histories, right? Is there any difference? I didn't find any, right?
Well, that's what I
don't mean differences of emphasis.
No, I understand. That's what, that's
of structure, of reality, et cetera.
So I would say at a mathematical level, there's almost no difference. The mathematical objects one deals with are the same ones. The questions one asks are different. So in the decoherent histories, you want to partition. We have this quantum measure. I don't know if it got lost or not, but maybe it got lost. This mu of E, it's not, as I pointed out, cannot be interpreted as a probability for various reasons. So I would say there's a fork in the road. The decoherence people, decoherent histories or consistent histories say, we must have probabilities. So we'll limit the questions we ask to certain special sets called decoherent, where there's no interference among the different events in that partition. And then we can interpret it as a probability. At an interpretive level, we would go in another direction and say, we want to take this seriously, even in situations where it can't be regarded as a probability, and ask what is it telling us about the microscopic quantum world in that case. That would get into a discussion that I evaded, but one concrete thing I can refer to is the work by Alvaro that gives you an experimental meaning to this quantum measure. In situ, Alvaro, the name is, oh, it's a paper of Alvaro Mosotto. It's a name. It's a name. It's a person. Yeah. Where we actually show how to experimentally give meaning to these more this measure in more general. And I'll leave. If I enter into interpretation, then the answer will certainly not be short.
Your name is on this paper.
Yeah, I'm also on this. Yes.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
This is an incorrect application, Picard-Lipschitz theory.
Oh, I'm not saying it's an application of Picard-Lipschitz.
No, you made a point that the integral diverges.
Right.
It doesn't. You have to rotate the contours, all of the contours, first. What you did is the angular integral before rotating the contours.
Oh, I didn't rotate it. I didn't rotate anything. I'm not disputing that. In fact,
in this form, the Picard-Lipschitz applies and gives a cutoff. Partial integral.
Oh, that's my point, Jim.
I know. You're not allowed to do that. You're not guaranteed to get the same answer if you do partial integrals while it's still oscillatory. You must first rotate everything, and then you get it.
Well, yeah, so my so point that I was, yeah, I agree. I don't agree. It depends what it's proving. My point is that the integral is not in itself defined at all, that Picard-Lipschitz is actually giving, if you use it, is actually giving you a definition of the integral.
So
that's what I would say. Okay, so you have to tell me.
The demonstration that it's not defined is exactly what I warned against yesterday.
But how do you do it?
Partial integrals while it was still in facility, and only then tried to.
Okay, so how do we, well, we can discuss later. How do we define it without doing partial integrals and without rotating?
It's wonderful.
So was that the second question? Which?
Yes, that was it.
Because I have another.
Oh, yeah, another one. If it's really short, it's very short.
I'd like to know why, in your view, one should jump up and down. As you said,
yeah.
The lack of diffeomorphism invariants in some way of the Bach integral for gravity, and why one should not jump up and down, say, if that were the case, which it isn't, for Young Mills or for electromagnetism.
I'm not totally sure I understand the question, but I'm
just. The question is the following. The Bach integral as a function of the initial and the final geometries,
right.
If one calculates it as a propagator, is not annihilated by the generator
of the Wheeler dual. Yeah.
If you do it for Young Mills, it is for the corresponding generator. I think that's perfect.
Oh, you say what?
And yeah. It's a happy thing, but I wonder why you think it's a good thing within this.
I don't think it's a good thing or a bad thing, actually, but I think it makes a lot of difference to some people, because some people would like to use the path, like maybe Bianca will tell us, some people would like to use the path integral to produce solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So it's just, I think it's very worth knowing whether or not it does produce a solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation or does not. From my point of view, it's not a burning issue one way or the other. We just need to make sense of the double pass integral here. But they're related, of course, because this sum over the final, this final Q, or well, it's gone away, but the sum over the final endpoint of that path, you could view that as a kind of inner product on wave functions on three geometries. And then it would be very useful to know, is one trying to find an inner product on solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, or some other set of functions. So there's a relation there, but I'm not saying, The only reason I said you should have jumped up and down is because I think people did, it sort of went by too quickly. I think if people take that on board and are aware of that, it'll make an impact on their thinking, that's all.
Good. Thank you very much.